TNT Radio wants to know what you really think, because your opinion matters. At TNTRadio.live, upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Radio, second hour. We're here. And it's going to be kicking off pretty soon if we carry on this current trajectory. 90 seconds till midnight, says the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And leading the cheer and leading the charge on this is a failed comedian, sitcom actor, who was doing low-grade vaudeville in a European backwater television market. So imagine if you live in the UK, France, Germany, the United States, or Canada, or Australia and New Zealand for that matter. So these are first world countries, supposedly advanced, and everybody listening who has, you know, I know that a lot of people who listen to this network, TNT, well, they're not television watchers. They're sort of smart people that want to get informed and, you know, learn things. They're kind of old school like that. So they don't watch a lot of TV. But everybody listening at one point probably did watch some TV before they kind of woke up out of the slumber and take responsibility about getting informed and educated, getting awake. And when you watch TV in US, in Europe, Britain, Australia, whatever, that even in a well-developed media market like that, even in a top sort of first world advanced country, you know, big media industry, big entertainment industry, you know, world class, even Australia's a small country population wise, but it's got a world class, you know, television, film, music, culture. It's on par with America. Okay, Canada the same, you know, and still you have really bad comedy. You have really bad entertainers that somehow maneuver their way into the top echelon of the media market in these countries. Okay, so even in the U.S. in the United States, the cream's supposed to rise to the top, and if it's a bigger market and there's more competition, you'd think that what's mainstreamed is the best. You think it's the creme de la creme, the absolute best, but it's not. A lot of times it's the opposite. It's absolute garbage. So if that happens in a top country, a top market, imagine a European backwater like Ukraine, a cultural wasteland. In terms of why, when I say that about Ukraine, I'm not talking about traditional Ukrainian culture. I'm talking about Eurotrash. In Ukraine, If you study their media landscape, and that's not to say that Ukraine does not have its share of great writers, poets, and, you know, people in the sort of literary arts and things like that, and linguistically, it's interesting dialect, interesting language, and a lot of good artists as well have come out of Ukraine. A lot of great creative people, a lot of great filmmakers. But I've seen some of their television is really sort of downgrade. It's really bad. And watch some of the cabaret that they do on TV. It reminds me of a really bad British TV from like 1960s or something, or 70s. And that's just this decade. So Ukraine is kind of like, maybe, you know, it's a backwater for a media market. And so in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And so Zelensky was king, he was sort of king of that media market. It was really, really dodgy television programming. And he's, you know, regarded as this sort of top-level comedian stroke actor. And think how cynical everybody was. They just allowed the United States to come in and stage a coup in their own country and mobilize a whole sort of platoons of neo-Nazis to go and basically kind of Antifa, but with swastikas and weapon and firearms, okay, and overthrow the democratically elected president of Ukraine. And the world celebrated this as a victory of democracy. You see how inverted everything is. And what came out of that eventually, well, first was Petro Poroshenko, who's a sort of corrupt chocolate mogul, oligarch, really just a real thick individual, somehow found his way into money. And they put him in as president. And he just, you know, completely ballsed up the country and then deployed the military to hunt down his own people in the eastern provinces, in the Donbass, and called everybody living in, all the Russian speakers, anybody who wasn't on board with the coup, called them terrorists and deployed his military against his own people. And that's the thing they decried Bashar al-Assad for, using the military against your own people. So, and Libya as well, they use that same line to delegitimize and make Gaddafi illegal, Slobodan Milosevic. It's the same, it's the same playbook. But when the US-backed Ukrainian oligarch did it, it was perfectly fine because those people are Russian and Russians are bad. That's the Western general thinking. Russians are bad, so if some Russians die, it's not a big deal because they're not good people, and they, you know, you got to knock them into line. If they're not going to comply, then you got to have to wipe them out. That's the Western attitude. It's so corrupt. But that's what led to the crisis that culminated last February 26th when Russia invaded Ukraine in what Russia calls a special military operation. They laid out their objectives quite clearly before that Ukraine cannot be a NATO cudgel. So we're going to demilitarize Ukraine. We're going to denazify Ukraine because you have large battalions, 20,000-30,000 plus, dominated by Nazis, proper criminals, ideologues, extremists, and, you know, just dangerous criminal ideologues, Nazis, and too many of them. They dominate the ranks of Ukrainian nationalists within the armed forces and politics. Very dangerous. They're marching and paying homage to World War II Nazi leaders who ran concentration camps, pogroms, killed Poles, Jews, etc. That's okay for the EU, though. That's okay for Britain and the US because the public have been brainwashed, pure and simple. And now you've got a low-grade television comedian who played the president in a sitcom and ran for president 2 years later, 3 years later, and got elected, supposedly, took the youth vote because the youth watched trash television. And they thought they were already primed for him to be president by watching him on TV. Rag to riches, became president. That was the plot of the show. And of course, when he ran, it made sense to people. Say, yeah, let's put him in. He does a good job as president in his sitcom on this sort of, you know, downgrade Ukrainian television sitcom. He's doing really good there. Maybe he can run the country during its most crucial time in its history with an ongoing bloody civil war. Why not put the most ridiculous comedian into power? That shows you where Ukraine is as a country. Politically bankrupt, intellectually bankrupt, the people are detached from reality. I mean, why would you put a fool like this? The only thing he can do, his only skill is he plays to the camera. That's it. Hasn't published a manifesto, no books, hasn't given any interesting political speeches. They wrote him a bunch of speeches when he campaigned. He said, I'm going to stop the civil war. I'm going to bring the Russians together with the Ukrainians. We're all going to have peace and we're going to end the hostilities. Of course, that was music to the ears of the people, especially the youth. They thought, you know, he's going to get us into Europe. He's going to stop the war. This is perfect. This, boom, we want him to be president. Of course, he doesn't have the ability to do any of that stuff. In fact, he did the opposite. But people were so cynical, and maybe rightfully so. Maybe Ukraine was so corrupt politically that they just threw their hands in the air and said, we've had enough. We'll take the clown. Put the clown in and see how he does. They did. They tried. They put the clown in, and look what happened. It's not Putin's fault what's happened. It's the clown's fault. Maybe the clown doesn't have any power. Maybe he's just a puppet. But he's the president of the country. So at some point, he's got to own it. 60,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers, 250,000 casualties, injuries. These are people in combat, military positions. He lost a third of his country, land mass. It's gone. It's never coming back. The economy is below zero. He's surviving off foreign handouts. There's no industry, and he cut off Russian energy that would have been a cheap available source of energy for his people. Instead, they got rolling blackouts. How much more of a failure do you need to know? Is this a success? Is this good? He started a war. Zelensky could have avoided the war, but he couldn't do anything because he was a puppet. He was being pushed and goaded and prodded by the United States, by Britain. And so he got the result they wanted because he didn't know what he wanted, because he's not a seasoned politician. He's never done public service. He is a cheap vaudeville comedian and probably a head case, and probably he's got all sorts of other problems, recreational problems, that are starting to manifest themselves, or people have seen really on full display for last year. This guy's a basket case. And the world's treating him like he's the Messiah, which shows you how screwed up our world is, how inverted our world is. And that's the mascot. He's the mascot for the planet right now. He is the perfect representation of where Western society is. Western society is Zelensky. I can't put it any more pure and poetic than that. Let's take a quick break here with TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back, and we'll hopefully catch up with our friend Matthew Russell Lee in the next segment. Stick around after these messages.
You should hear what Dirk Bowman is talking about.
Maybe you explain to our listeners how you became enemy of the state. Well, maybe not number one, but at least in the top 10 in Germany.
In 2021, for the first time, I went to Donbass. Didn't plan to stay there, but after I've seen what is going on there, so that there's Ukrainian army is killing civilians there already for 8 years, I was shocked. And I decided to stay. I opened a Telegram channel and started to tell about the story of Donbass, about the people. After the special operation of Russia began, my channel got pretty popular in Germany because I was the only German on the ground. And Germany was supporting the Ukrainian government from the beginning, so they didn't like what I was doing and started to talk in a very bad way about me in all news and television, and even blocked the bank accounts of not only of myself but of my parents too. And yeah, this is how I became an enemy of Germany. I'm now in Russia and I can't go back because they also opened a criminal case against me.
The Dirk Bowman Show on Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and they can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization, the left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for, you know, for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left were trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, you know, about old white men are a problem. Except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden, then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at salemnow.com.
You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. Welcome back. We're into the second hour of this live broadcast here, and we're going to connect in just a few minutes our legal correspondent, Matthew R. Lee. He's going to join us from the Big Apple in New York, where all the action's happening. And we just wanted to touch base with, we'll touch base with him in a couple of minutes. We'll probably connect him on the fly. The bottom of the half hour mark, the 30 minute mark. Hopefully we'll be able to get a good signal, a good line. He might be ducking off into the stairwell from the courts. Might be a busy week, I would think, this week in the Southern District of New York. And Matthew's always got some interesting stuff to share with us. And usually it's a door into what's going on in politics. It's always good to be there at the source. We're very privileged to be able to do that. But before we connect, I will just shift gears here. Speaking of the clown in Kiev, and I don't mean to overdo it, but they asked this guy, and these interviews are too much. And he's just such an affable, nice chap. And it's just like, yeah, but, you know, look at what he's done to his country. They're conscripting Hungarian Carpathians. Okay. Zelensky is running press gangs. Do you know what a press gang is? It's not a gang of journalists looking for a story. A press gang are groups of thugs that go out to impress people into military service. Okay? That's what a press gang is. And this is a common practice in Zelensky's Ukraine. If you are a male between the age of 18 and 65 or 60, they're pulling granddads and throwing them in trenches on the front line. That's the glorious fight waged by Slava Ukraini, okay? Throwing granddads in the trenches, press gangs, going around impressing people into military service to go be fodder in NATO's proxy war. I can't think of a more unglorious way to spend your life or the remaining days of your life than to do that. There's nothing patriotic about it. There's nothing noble about it. It's just insanity. It's so corrupt. And here's this clown fawning to the cameras. What a little maniac he really is. And he thinks he's Al Pacino, and then the Kay Burley, this sort of typical mainstream safe pair of hands, and saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if Boris Johnson was prime minister? Would you support Boris Johnson be prime minister again? Having this nice, affable political conversation with the Ukrainian president. And here's his answer, and he plays it off, and He's calling Rishi Sunak. Rishi, my buddy Rishi. It's too much. It's nauseating. Here he goes.
How would you feel if he ran again to be prime minister? Would he get your support?
I think that is not correct to me to support Johnson to be a prime minister when Rishi is prime minister. It's not correct. I'm sorry. We have good relations with Sunak. I think we had more long relations with Johnson because it was more long time. And of course,
That's quite profound what Zelensky said. He said, we had a more long relations with Johnson because he served a longer time. It's very profound. And that's a little look into the political depth of this little shyster in Kiev. Here he goes.
And of course, very difficult time at the first days of full-scale invasion. That's why I saw Johnson in different situations. I saw him not in war and then in full-scale war. That's why we have special relations.
He really looks like he's been up all night with Sean Penn. I mean, it's just kind of obvious. It's written all over his face. And it's shocking. It really is. He's been on a tube. It looks like he's been on a 2-day bender with Sean Penn. And he just popped a couple Valium right before the interview. And that's what it looks like. The guy is so strung out. So, I mean, gosh, if it's that bad, just run your ops from Warsaw. Do you know what I mean? Or Miami. Or London. Or Paris. Or just be that government in exile. Enjoy it. You'd be the next Shah of Iran. Maybe that's where it's all heading. A glorious government in exile. Wait for the military coup. The problem with Ukraine is they're running out of able-bodied men. And there's only so many granddads you can snatch from the public pool in the summer. Okay, there's only so many Hungarian Carpathians you can kidnap in order to be in your military, okay? This is what Zelensky is doing. This is where this regime is at, and it's a travesty. It's a travesty that Western governments are backing this blight on history, which is exactly what it is. Keep demonizing Putin, demonizing Russians. Keep exaggerating the performance of the Ukrainian military, saying that victory is just around the corner. They've been saying that since last March. Victory is just around the corner. I'll make a bet with you. If this story keeps going the way it's going, Odessa will not be part of Ukraine this time next year. I'm just saying. And it won't be from the outside that it collapses. It'll be from the inside. Just saying. And then it's over. What will the West do to avert that disaster? Lob a nuclear war? Tactical nuke false flag? Blame it on Putin? What will they do? How far will they go? That's anyone's guess. Pretty scary stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Pretty scary stuff. But this is what we have to contend with, unfortunately. So I don't really know what to say other than this gravy train still's got some juice left in it. And as much as I would like to say that this would all be done and dusted, one would hope so sooner than later. A quick Russian victory might make you feel good. It might mean less people are going to die. But people in Washington, London don't care about that because they're not doing the dying. Ukraine's doing the dying. So it can just go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Send a few mercenaries in. A few Western mercenaries to stiffen up those battalions, right? Stiffen up those battalions. Raise morale. These guys have to buy their own bullets. Do you realize that? They have to buy their own bullets, buy their own uniforms, buy their own food, bring their own food with them when they go sit in the trenches, buy their own drugs. How do you stay up at night? Capticon, what do they use? ISIS like Capticon, amphetamines, angel dust. You think I'm kidding? That's exactly what life is like. You wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy, but NATO has wished it on the entire Ukrainian population, and they are quite happy. They're quite happy about it. Not going to bat an eyelid. So look, we're going to go shift gears a little bit. Before we do, we'll try to connect our good friend and legal correspondent, Matthew Russell Lee, with Inner City Press. We'll try to get him on the live link right now. Actually, we'll do a quick call. We'll do a sort of a graze, a sort of stealth bombing pass over, and try to connect Matt from his place there in New York, and be very interested to see what he's got for us this week. It's always going to be an adventure. And when one of the things, there's a few stories that we're looking at, I'm sure he'll be able to get us a little bit of a look in on some of the big stories. But one, certainly the Sam Bankman-Fried story is going to be interesting, how that plays out. But there's a number of other interesting things that have unfolded as well in the meantime. But let's try to connect him now. I think with Matthew Lee on the line. Matthew, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Pretty well. Then there was actually, I've obviously very much on the Sam Bankman-Fried case, but there are other cases, including a rare federal death penalty case here in the Southern District Courthouse, in which yesterday there was a guilty verdict in the first phase, which means the person did it. There wasn't much doubt about that. It's a guy who drove a Home Depot truck at high speed down a bike path in Lower Manhattan and killed 8 people. Saipov is his name. He's from Uzbekistan. So that's been like the main, people have been really focusing on that. There are a lot of other trials going on, but he was found guilty on 28 charges, including several death penalty charges. And the death penalty phase will begin on February 6th.
So was that premeditated? That was ruled premeditated?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the reason I'm bringing it up is it actually kind of raises some interesting issues. Very much premeditated. He didn't just flip out or not take his meds that day. It's what is strange is that he immigrated legally from Uzbekistan. Again, I'm not saying this is any kind of, you know, what do you call it, count anti-extremist. It's just what came out at trial was a kind of a, I don't think he came as a sleeper person. I think he came because there were Uzbeks living in the Midwest, and then he got a job as an Uber driver. He was living in New Jersey. Somehow he became radicalized, mostly listening to al-Baghdadi speeches and reading. And relatively, from any outside, he had a wife, 3 kids. He has now. He's been in jail ever since 2017. Not just one day, like a week before he did it, he did a trial run. He rented a truck from the Home Depot, turned it back in. It's like a truck you deliver like plywood or sheetrock on. It can go pretty quickly. Although it came out of trial that it has some kind of speed regulation to not, you know, they don't want Home Depot to be associated with speeding tickets. But you can do a lot of damage at 55 miles an hour. He absolutely premeditated. He crossed a bridge from New Jersey. He was going down the West Side Highway, and then I don't know if that's still the case over there. There was a place where a vehicle could, if it chose, come off the highway and get into a wide bike path. A lot of people were biking. Actually, most of the victims, 8 people were killed. Most of the actual, you know, killed, deceased victims were tourists or visitors from Belgium and Argentina. That's why it sort of has an international flavor, not just the talk of ISIS. But I'll get to the legal point is this, and this is why I think interesting. The government, this would begin under the Trump administration, but the Biden administration was asked, was it still seeking the death penalty here? And they said they are. And that stands in contrast to a case that's taken place more recently in El Paso, Texas, where in a hate attack, a man shot and killed 23 people in the Walmart parking lot. You may have heard of that. This is a U.S. thing. But they were nearly all Hispanic Mexican Americans, and the guys spouted anti-Mexican rhetoric. But he's not getting, they're not pursuing the death penalty on him. So this is kind of a holdover from Trump. At the same time, that maybe the Biden administration is afraid to, like, if they stop pursuing the death penalty, they look weak. So they're just doing it. But they've hung their hat on a strange legal theory, which is that it's like racketeering. It's basically the statute that was passed to go after the mafia says a crime is particularly bad if you do it in order to join or rise up in a racketeering conspiracy. So the problem they have here is they tried to say ISIS is a racketeering conspiracy, which I think is already a little strange. They can be a terrible group without being racketeering. It seems like a strange fit. But the biggest problem that they had, and they're going to have in the second phase, is that did Saifullah Saipov do this to join and rise up in ISIS, or did he do it to die and you know, go to heaven with 77 virgins? And it seems like the latter was what he had in mind. From his prison writings after the fact, from things that he said. And so there were a number of jurors, that was what sort of threw the trial into chaos. Juries started sending out notes saying, if we find that he didn't do it to join or rise up in ISIS, and we therefore throw out the case, will he be tried again on better charges? And the government was like, no, you cannot give them this feeling that it could work out if they drop it. And then very soon after that, they came back with a guilty verdict. He has like six lawyers from the federal defenders. So I think this is going to, even if it's voted on to give him the death penalty, he's not going to get it for like 10 years, 20 years. He may never get it, even if it were voted on. But it is a kind of a legal, I'm sure this issue of the racketeering charge and also the way that the jury was instructed, all of it's going to become grounds for appeal to the highest court. So I'm sorry for the long explanation.
No, sir. Federal death penalties is very rare, isn't it, to be issued a death penalty at the federal level. I mean, Timothy McVeigh comes to mind. That was a strange case, actually. But it's not a normal occurrence, is it?
Not at all. I mean, as people know, it was obviously on hold as cruel and unusual punishment under a Supreme Court decision, and that was taken away. There remains here's another, again, this is legal schmeagle, but the way the Federal Death Penalty Act is written, the same jurors have to participate in the first, and that's why you have two phases of the trial. It's required. First, you liability phase, guilty or not guilty, and then separately, allowing the defense to, once it's established, now he doesn't have to pretend to be in it. He can plead mitigation, right? He can say, I did do it, but I was fooled by al-Baghdadi, whatever he wants to try to say. It has to be the same jurors, and the federal defenders are arguing that it has to be the exact same 12, meaning in the first stage there were 12, actual jurors and six alternates in case people came down with COVID or somebody had to travel. And now the federal defenders are arguing that those six alternates, they cannot, even if they heard all of the evidence in the first phase, they couldn't vote on the death or not because they didn't vote on the first range, which means it's going to be very tricky in the second phase, which may go on for weeks. If a single juror comes down sick or is required to travel or has some, maybe the trial would be put on pause, but it's a case of first impression. Like, this Federal Death Penalty Act was enacted by Congress before COVID, before you had all these, sort of routinization of needing more alternates and some jurors dropping out. Not that they die, but that they get sick, So that's going to be another. There's all kinds of appealable issues in this one. I did want to say, based on our conversation from last week, I asked the UN in writing. The UN, of course, is on record as saying they're against the death penalty and that they think, and this is a vote in the General Assembly, that they think that countries should either outlaw it or have a moratorium on it. But surprise, surprise, when asked about the Saipov case, no answer. And even closer to the bone, Mali recently imposed, they haven't carried it out yet, but imposed a death penalty on somebody that killed a UN peacekeeper, was found to have killed a peacekeeper. So I asked the UN, what do you think of that? Because they're always saying it's an international crime to attack peacekeepers, but what about killing the person who did it? Of course, they didn't answer that. That's one of the reasons that I want to get back in the buildings. I think it's one of these, they would need to say, yes, they should get life in prison. Whatever they need, it's a word. All the UN has is words. So when they won't even come up with words on the issue of the day, and just choose to keep cashing the checks as they do, there's a problem.
Yes, and also on the other end of this, I don't know if you. This is just I'm taking a little bit of a sidebar here.
No problem, Matthew.
But there, Bill Barr, former Attorney General, briefly under Trump, he wrote his memoirs recently, and he made a statement that raised a lot of eyebrows. And you might have some knowledge of the Maxwell and Epstein cases, but in, as they relate to New York, he said when he first heard the news that Jeffrey Epstein was dead, his first reaction was to his aides. He said, well, this is going to be a problem because it's going to be hard to convince the public that this was a suicide. He made that statement before there was any ruling on whether it was a suicide. It, it raised a lot of suspicion, actually. Not to mention, that's a very dodgy, you know, that that federal holding facility in downtown New York.
I'm about 100 yards from it. It's empty now. It's now that that Metropolitan Correctional Center is now empty. But it was a bad one. There's a lot of bad jails. But yeah, I do remember that. Go on. There's another Epstein connection here. I'm always got one in the back pocket.
Well, well, as the chief law enforcement, he said we're going to get to the bottom of this. He made a big announcement. Of course, we're going to find out what happened. And they never did any investigation. There was no footage released of there. They said the cameras weren't working. They've let off the two guards that supposedly fell asleep. They've been their charges have been quietly dropped, and the body was moved. There's no photograph of the place where the body actually was.
That's true. There's a fairly ghoulish, I believe, New York Post photo of it being rolled into a hospital near here. But even then, there's, people say it's not him. So there's a lot of, I totally agree. There's a lot of, the connection I was just going to say is, I hope I'm not misremembering this, but I think Bill Barr was a very kind of patrician, you know, Upper East Side, affluent area of New York City guy. And I believe that his father was the principal of Dalton School, where Epstein got his first teaching job without even having a college degree. He became a math teacher there. And that's sort of, people say not only was it the beginning of his life as a pedophile, but it was also the beginning of his life of ingratiating himself to extremely, it was a, it's a very expensive private school, of ingratiating himself to rich New York. Maybe serving their you know, depraved desires, or maybe gathering blackmail material against them. In any event, no one can ever quite figure out how he got that job. And the person who gave him that job was, I believe, Bill Barr's father. It's both a small world and a strange one, you know?
Yeah, very small world, very small world. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the heads of some of these top investment banks, their kids went to that school.
Oh, totally, absolutely.
Including Bear Stearns, where he got his first, where Epstein got his first gig.
That's correct, actually. I think that is how old Ace discovered his ace in the hole, whatever hole we're talking about, Jeffrey Epstein. I think that was a clean, right? It was a nasty implication. It didn't violate seven dirty words. I didn't want to, I'm not going to say mea culpa, but I want to say, I think we've spoken, or I've certainly had this thought, that the Virgin Islands sold out. Do you remember what I'm, there are cases by Epstein victims against Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan Chase, both filed right at the cusp of the year under a New York State looking back law where you can sort of get around the statute of limitations. And this was quickly followed by a case filed against JP Morgan by the U.S. Virgin Islands, where, of course, Jeffrey Epstein had his head. There's a big nexus there. And so they I don't want to say piled on, they filed suit. And almost immediately, the Attorney General of the Virgin Islands who filed the suit was fired. So there was, I may have even helped, you know, jumped on and said, that looks weird. It was right after Biden went on vacation there, and there was a lot of, I want to say, whether it's mea culpa or just an update, an amplification, since we last spoke, in fact, this week, maybe even yesterday, possibly Wednesday night, the U.S. Virgin Islands filed what's called letters rogatory. We're going to take you through all the legal weeds here. This is a way in which you get a U.S. court to sign a discovery order to people in other countries over whom they would otherwise have no jurisdiction. But a U.S. judge agrees to sign, and they don't send it to the person in the other country. They send it to the legal their equivalent, the Attorney General. In this case, the U.S. Virgin Islands, who when last we spoke seemed to be selling out or punishing the person who went after Chase about Epstein, has now gotten signed letters rogatory to a woman called Kathy Alexander, who was the manager of Little St. James Pedophile Island. And they've asked Kathy Alexander, now living in South Africa, for all of her communications about Epstein, Maxwell, Sarah Kellen, a slew of other individuals of whose names I've put up both on Inner City Press and on Patreon. They've got the whole letter if you want the real scoop. But the real scoop here is that it's not over. It's not, this Virgin Islands, I don't know why they fired the lady, but they didn't stand down. Maybe they were chastened when they were accused of selling out, because they are now pursuing, and this information, I don't know if we'll ever get to see it, because it's information that will be given to the Virgin Islands and that they can, they may or may not use in their lawsuit. We'd have no, it's not like it'll ever be filed with a court where we can then try to unseal it. But in any event, it's you know, I didn't even know she was living in South Africa. I'm sure that the real Epstein files knew that, but I didn't.
That's interesting. That's opens up another strange leaf to that story for sure. Yeah. But let's take a quick break with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Haynes. I'm here with our legal correspondent, Matthew Russell Lee. He's based in New York at the Southern District of New York Courthouse. We're talking about Epstein and other things as well. We'll be back after these messages. Stay right there.
Saving the planet is for extraterrestrials from the World Economic Forum? That's what John Kerry just said.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry raised eyebrows when he compared himself to an extraterrestrial at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
And when you stop and think about it, it's pretty extraordinary that we, select group of human beings, because of whatever touched us at some point in our lives, are able to sit in a room and come together and actually talk about saving the planet. I mean, it's so almost extraterrestrial to think about, quote, saving the planet. And if you said that to most people, they think you're just a crazy tree-hugging, lefty, liberal, you know, do-gooder, whatever.
They are the elites, the chosen one. And I offer you this. The Roswell, New Mexico incident of extraterrestrial activity happened in July 1947, and almost 9 months later to the date exactly, in March 1948, Al Gore was born. I'm just saying. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio. Thank you.
How about some good news? There is a cure for hepatitis C. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. One little blood test and you'll have done your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested. Get treated. Get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in the final stretch of the final hour of the show today. And joining us on the line is our legal correspondent, Matthew Russell Lee. He's based in New York, hanging out and with his ear to the ground at the Southern District of New York, the federal court there. A lot of interesting cases go through there, but also has his ear on what's happening at the UN as well. That used to be his regular beat. But before the break, Matt,
I'm going to add another agency, Patrick. I'm going to shock you with this one. Not just legal buzzwords. Are you ready for the Federal Reserve? Are you prepared? Because it's going to connect to FTX. And here goes. This is breaking news today. Just decided the Federal Reserve has denied an application by something called Custodia Bank of Wyoming, a largely crypto-based institution, to join the Federal Reserve system. The Fed, the Federal Reserve, which until now was relatively lax and in fact allowed FTX to take a $50 million stake in a minuscule Washington State Bank called Farmington State Bank, which they renamed Moonstone, which was widely criticized in Congress and subject to a FOIA request from yours truly about why they did it, has now reversed course and apparently will be denying all applications from banks involved in crypto to make it look like they are protecting the financial system. It's kind of after the horse is out of the barn, but it literally was announced by the Fed with much fanfare this morning. And they haven't even released the denial order yet. They say it has to be cleaned up of confidential information. But this, I know that I heard on the way in, you were talking FTX, and that, I see it as very much connected. I see this as agencies and those who were complicit in the corrupt and you know, circus-like enterprise that was FTX, all trying to say, it wasn't us, you know, look at us now. And the question is, can your later corrective action change what you did at the time? And I think not, as a matter of law. Back to you.
No, that's interesting. Moonstone Bank, they would name it Moonstone. It's kind of a new agey, you know, feminine crystal. Maybe his polyamorous girlfriend, partner, she's into that sort of thing. It's bizarre. Moonstone. It's really bizarre.
You're right. The investment actually was through Alameda Research, which is the Carolyn Ellison, who has pled guilty, who's in the bullpen, warming up in the bullpen, as we say in baseball, or maybe like on the side of the pitch or in the – she's waiting to testify against her one-time paramour, Sam Bankman-Fried. Let me say in sadness and in madness, actually, anger, I mean, that we still don't know who the co-signers are. We haven't been denied, but blow these basically 3 weeks or more, going on 4 weeks, since we filed an application to unseal the names and Bankman-Fried's lawyers opposed it, the judge still hasn't ruled. Now, I remain hopeful that he may release it, but he ordered them temporarily sealed pending what he called the motion practice. But the motion practice is over. There was a motion to unseal. We filed one. Then, of course, the New York Times, everybody else filed. Now they opposed it, and now it's just waiting. Meanwhile, while he has a rule on it, while it's pending, let's put it that way, I go to the magistrate's court here every day, and I see people's co-signers reveal their names, addresses, and incomes in open court every day. So it really is a case where Bankman-Fried is being treated differently and with more kid gloves than other defendants, other financial defendants. I think it's indefensible, but we'll see if Judge Lewis A. Kaplan agrees. Mm-hmm. Hopefully by our next time, we'll have a ruling on that. That would be my hope.
So you're saying that the because of the blow up of FTX and the whole sort of collapse of that crypto empire, that the Federal Reserve is canceling previously agreed or arranged deals with different banks to work.
I would say that, yeah, this one was pending, this application by Custodia, but they thought I tweeted only about an hour ago when I wrote the story on the Fed thing. And I guess I'm here. I'm also trying to say this segment can deal with that because that's, I don't go to DC all the time, although I'll be there not, but I cover the Fed and they give me, you know, fee waivers for FOIA requests and expedited treatment. I've been inside, I've met the governors, but I'm not a fan. I think that they are for all of their seeming, you know, there's a lot of things to be said about the Fed, but my focus on them is I think they're really lax regulators, believe it or not. Some people think they're too tough. I think that they're, and the proof of the pudding is they allowed Farmington State Bank, Moonstone Bank is its street name, in the same way that, like, there was, you know, there's a criminal today this week called Jeriel Abreu, aka Johnny Guns. So I think in the same way, Farmington State Bank is aka Moonstone Bank,
right?
And the Fed let them in. There's a letter. It's signed. It's signed by the San Francisco Fed. So, not only are they lax, they're very pro bank in the sense that we try to do FOIA requests while a merger is pending and say, give us the documents so we can use them to comment on the merger or to report on the merger. In any event, while it's still a live question, and the Fed will say, we grant you expedited treatment and then not rule, and then rubber stamp the application. So it's that's a beat, and it's a good beat. I think the one thing I like about that beat is, and this is the difference between, you know, the Federal Reserve and the UN or any U.S. institution, actually. And I don't mean to say they're all good. but they've all heard of the First Amendment. You know what I mean? Even if they've tried to find ways to violate it, the UN may have heard of it, but they just don't care. If they don't want to hear a question, they just apply force and then apply a ban and then surround themselves with sycophants. And the next thing you know, the UN this week claimed to have a good week. They sent their deputy secretary general to Afghanistan to waggle her finger at the Taliban. That was enough. No change in policy, nothing. But just to stay relevant seems to be their current lowered expectations for the United Nations is just to be in the mix. Like, they're not stopping the war in Ukraine, but they're going to help sell grain for Ukraine and ammonia for Russia. They're not actually doing anything about the Taliban, but they got somebody in there. She's a woman, looks very courageous, but they can't handle any questions about it. And the woman they send is herself more corrupt than the Taliban. Why do I say that? The woman's name is Amina J. Mohammed. She's the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, the second highest official, formerly the Environment Minister of Nigeria. And in that function, just before she took the job, after she'd taken the job at the UN, but before she flew to New York with a huge retinue of people, she backdated thousands of CITES, they're called, certificates to export endangered rosewood to China, rosewood from Nigeria and Cameroon. Because she wanted to do them the favor before she left, she signed 6,000 in one night. She didn't sleep. And now she comes to the UN and talks about climate change and the environment and the Taliban. And it's like, you're a criminal. Every day I cover criminal cases where somebody goes to jail for that kind of paperwork chicanery, you know, mm-hmm. and they just never had to answer on it.
Wow. So, you know, knowing what you know there, what you're describing, there's people that were saying that, you know, wouldn't it be great if the United Nations was the global government, if we had a one world government, and it wouldn't be great to be less corrupt, it would be more transparent, it wouldn't have all these problems we have at the national level. It's so politicized and so corrupt, and money, you know, big money and big oil and big this and that. What would your answer be to anybody who's proposing that?
Absolutely. On everything that you mentioned, I'll forget just my own experience of like they're willing to throw out journalists whose questions they don't like. Believe this, the United Nations has no Freedom of Information Act-like procedure at all. The entity that talks about global governance and that takes taxpayers' money has no mechanism by which anyone can know how the money is spent. There is no FOIA. There's not only no First Amendment, meaning a protection for critical reporting, but there's no FOIA either. And the thing is, I heard the segment between our two segments where one of your, I guess, colleagues on the station was referring somewhat comedically to John Kerry. People like John Kerry are the kinds that, like, as a kind of a knee-jerk way of like the UN, you know, we're working with the UN, the UN's trying to solve climate change. I guarantee you, the UN is an absolute travesty. The head of the UN flies around with no transparency at all. He was flying, when I was able to really track it, when I was before being banned from the building, he would fly to Lisbon every weekend, because his wife, who was like the culture minister of Lisbon, never moved to New York. She also never moved to Geneva when he lived there. It's a long story, and it's maybe a sad one. None of my business. But what is my business, at a minimum, if he wants to fly back to Lisbon every weekend as if it were like a normal commute, that's fine. But if you're a public servant and you're using taxpayer money to fly and taking six bodyguards with you, even though no one recognizes this guy on the street, they just think he's another dumpy businessman. Don't you have to disclose how much you're spending? No, apparently not. You know, even Mayor Bloomberg, who spent his own money to fly from New York to his Caribbean island, ended up having to disclose his public schedule. Why? Because that's what transparency means. It means the leader having to, like, if not change their behavior, disclose where they went, what they did, what they spent, have a visitor's log. I guarantee you the UN has no visitor's log. And before I was thrown out of the building, they stopped me from going to photo ops because it was the only way to know what was happening up there. I would sign up. They'd say, today at 1 p.m., he's meeting the foreign minister of Slovenia. And I'd be the only photographer. My friend gave me a camera. I showed up. I'm ready to go. I go upstairs, and the things that you would see, you know what I mean? So then they said, no more. This is only for wire service photography. Uh-huh. How is that the fault? InterCity Press is a wire. I got a wire. No, apparently not the right wire. You know, the right wire means you have blinders on. You look at what they tell you to look at.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The only certain journalists, only certain,
totally.
Certain.
Yeah, they made that clear. I want to be very conscious. I have much more to say, but I'm very conscious of our possibly hard stop, as they say, you know?
No, yeah, no, we are. We're coming up to the hard stop of this end of the show at the second hour. So we'll save a little bit for next time, Matthew.
Okay.
So
there are more vitriol and more legal buzzwords than you can shake a stick at.
Oh, I'm sure. But no, we really appreciate you joining us this week. And certainly there's a lot to think about there. I'll have some more questions for you next week as well. But all the best, Matthew Lee, Inner City Press. Thank you.
Okay. Until the next time.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. And also a big thank you to everybody, our listeners, and everybody in the chat room as well. You guys have been amazing. So do stick around, however. Stay on the live broadcast here, and we'll be joined after the top of the hour news headlines by Jesse Zurawell and his program. Always informative, always interesting. Listen, take care, you guys. Have a great weekend, and I will see you on Sunday at the Sunday Wire, and again on Monday here, same time with TNT. All the best. Take care.